From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the first month in office of the only president who was never elected president or vice president, we talk with Barry Wirth. His new book, 31 Days, is about the transition after Nixon resigned and Ford took the oath of office. Two key players in the book are Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Also, we talk with journalist Neil McFarquhar. His new book, The Sand Cafe, is a satirical novel based on his experiences covering the Gulf War. He later served as the New York Times Cairo bureau chief. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the word alien and the meanings that have been attached to it. And critic-at-large John Powers tells us about two hit movies from South Korea now out on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gerald Ford has the distinction of being the only president who was never elected president or vice president. When Nixon resigned on August 9, 1974, Ford had to hold the government and the country together. The first month of Ford's presidency is the subject of the new book, 31 Days. The book also explores the early careers of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney when they were Cold War hardliners and worked in the Ford administration. My guest is the author of 31 Days, Barry Wirth. Remind us of the unique position that President Ford was in, having never been elected as vice president.
Gerald Ford became vice president in October of 1973 after Nixon's first vice president, Spiro Agnew, resigned. He was facing a tax evasion charge. And there's so many things that make the Ford presidency unique, but one of them is that there were two-thirds Democratic majorities in Congress at that time, and Ford was not Nixon's first choice. In fact, he was probably his fourth or fifth choice, but the Democratic leadership in Congress made it very clear that only Gerry Ford would be acceptable. So Ford was chosen, and he had no aspiration to be president, so he was chosen more or less by mutual consensus between the White House and Congress, and he was chosen quite specifically because he didn't have any ambition to run for president himself. So when he came to office 10 months later, after Nixon's resignation, he was widely believed that he was not going to be running in 1976 in his own right, that he was going to be a caretaker. So here we have a man who was not elected to national office, had no aspiration to run for the presidency on his own, and had less than 48 hours to prepare for his presidency. Nixon, as we well remember, struggled to the bitter end to retain power and only left when confronted with certain impeachment in Congress. And when Ford was told that he would become president, he had 2 days to assemble a staff and to organize himself to become the world's most powerful political leader.
There was a transition team that was organized to help President Ford, and this transition team recommended that Ford not appoint a chief of staff at the outset, but that instead of a chief of staff, he should appoint someone who could rapidly and efficiently reorganize the staff, but who would not be perceived as chief of staff and would not be eager to become a chief of staff. And when Ford read this recommendation, he wrote in the margins, Rumsfeld. And that's the person who he chose. Why did he want Rumsfeld to be this transition manager?
Back in 1974, Rumsfeld was a former congressman from Illinois who had been instrumental in helping Ford rise through the congressional leadership. He was, fortunately for him, out of the White House during the most critical stages of Watergate. He was our NATO ambassador. But Ford knew that he needed to bring in somebody who would help him implement what he called a spokes-on-the-wheel organizational chart, as opposed to a top-down organizational chart, and who would not be afraid to move against the Nixon staff, somebody who was aggressive and unafraid to take on complicated problems, a maverick. He was comfortable with Rumsfeld from their service together in the House, and he thought that Rumsfeld was just the guy. But as you indicated in that that quote that you read, he wanted somebody to run the transition who did not want to be in that position and would not be perceived as wanting to be in that position. Ironically, just a couple of weeks after the pardon, Rumsfeld became Ford's so-called staff coordinator, but in fact he was chief of staff in the White House, and Dick Cheney was his deputy.
One of the big decisions Ford had to make was whether to keep Nixon's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger. Why was that a controversial decision?
The Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy, which was generally known by the term détente, which meant a lessening of tensions, was very controversial within the Republican Party. There were a lot of hardliners and hawks who felt that Nixon had gone soft on communism and that Kissinger's realism in foreign affairs was making the United States, as they put it, provocatively weak. it was probably the first truly controversial decision that Ford made. At the time, as someone put it, Henry Kissinger was America's foreign policy. Nixon had been so discredited by Watergate that Kissinger was America's face to the world. He was enormously popular, and he was enormously effective during the previous year in negotiating settlements between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Syria in the wake of the 1973 October War. So Ford felt very strongly that he needed Kissinger, but he knew that he was going to be inviting attack from the Republican right and from the so-called neocons who were just then beginning to address foreign policy issues.
And where did Rumsfeld stand on this?
At the time, Rumsfeld's charge was to stay away from foreign policy entirely. That was Kissinger's alone to run. When Rumsfeld and Cheney came into the White House to work on the transition, Ford was very explicit. He said, look at the Office of Management and Budget, look at the relationship between the White House and the cabinet departments, but stay away from foreign policy, stay away from defense, stay away from state. Subsequently, Rumsfeld challenged Kissinger, but at the time, Rumsfeld's duties were generally regarded as having to do totally with domestic politics.
What do you feel like you could learn about Rumsfeld and his deputy, Dick Cheney, by looking at their performance in the Ford administration?
Well, let me put it this way. Ford started out feeling very strongly that after Watergate and Vietnam, what the country needed to do was to move to the center. He adopted what one of the Washington Post writers called the mantle of the presidential center. The country had been so divided, so torn, and all power was reeling, and Ford was determined to unify the country. So he made a number of what in retrospect looked like extraordinary decisions. The first trip that he took outside of Washington, he went to the VFW convention in Chicago, really the most difficult audience he could find, to suggest that Vietnam War resistors should be welcomed home. There should be some sort of limited amnesty. He met with the Congressional Black Caucus, which Nixon had not met with for 5.5 years. Only once, in fact, did Nixon meet with that Congressional Caucus. He chose as his vice president Nelson Rockefeller, who was widely despised on the Republican right. And in fact, the choice of Rockefeller catalyzed right-wing opposition to Ford and galvanized support for Ronald Reagan, who challenged Ford in the 1976 primaries. So what you had was a president starting out trying to move to the middle, trying to work with the Democrats. And then with the pardon, his popularity plummeted, went from 70% to 48%, and never really recovered. At which point, Rumsfeld and Cheney came in and tried to direct the Ford presidency, which was increasingly faced with a challenge from the right. And they moved Ford as much as they could to face that challenge and to implement right-wing policies himself. So in the same sense that Rumsfeld and Cheney became the center of strategic power in the George W. Bush White House, they became the center of strategic power in the Ford White House, and they did then, in somewhat lesser form, what they have done subsequently, which is to make sure that they never get outflanked by the right.
One of the things that President Ford had to do early on was to choose a vice president. What does the Constitution say about the position that he was in and how to choose a vice president?
The Constitution didn't have a provision about this in well into this century. And in fact, after John Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, there was no vice president at all until Lyndon Johnson was elected in his own right in 1964 and Hubert Humphrey came on. After that, Congress passed the 25th Amendment, which says that if there's an unoccupied vice president's seat, that the president shall choose someone who to be confirmed by Congress. So this was really the signal decision of Ford's first couple of weeks. He was having the opportunity to pick somebody who, as far as anyone knew, was most likely going to be the Republican candidate in 1976, since Ford himself had pledged not to run.
So how was Rockefeller finally chosen by Ford as vice president?
Well, it's Ford wanted somebody who had independent standing and stature. And Rockefeller was, in his own right, one of the world's most powerful people, coming from his family and also having been the nationally very popular former two-term governor from New York. And he also wanted somebody who would be a strong ticket mate in 1976. Rockefeller, it was believed, could help Ford win New York, probably California, maybe Florida. And he also was in agreement with the Nixon-Kissinger realpolitik in foreign affairs. So Rockefeller was really the strongest person that Ford could have selected.
You keep describing Ford as being someone who didn't plan on running for the presidency, and no one expected him to run for the presidency. His vice presidential appointee was considered to be the next presidential candidate, but that's not the way it worked out. Ford did run.
Yes, he did run, and in fact, he made the decision very early. Let me say first that Betty Ford had hated being in Washington and had, as we know, struggled with addictions and had a very hard time as a political wife and really hoped that Ford would quit politics. In fact, Ford had planned after the 1972 election to leave Washington. His only real aspiration had been to be Speaker of the House, but he had not been able to win enough seats to make that happen. And so he first had to convince Betty that that he ought to run himself. But really what was more crucial, which was pointed out to him by Henry Kissinger on the second day of his presidency, was that if he was perceived as a caretaker, that would invite a succession fight within the party that would begin immediately, and that foreign powers would take him less seriously. He realized that in order to be perceived as a strong president, even during this interim period, he needed to run in 1976 and show that he intended to be president for longer than that.
My guest is Barry Wirth. His new book is called 31 Days. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barry Wirth. We're talking about his new book, 31 Days, which is about the first 31 days of the Ford presidency right after the resignation of President Nixon. One of the most important decisions that President Ford was faced with early on was whether or not to pardon Nixon. Why was that a decision that was filled with landmines along the way?
That's a very apt description. This could not have been an easy or straightforward decision under any circumstances. It was probably made more difficult by the fact that Ford owed his presidency to Nixon. But let me try to go through some of them. There were the legal issues first. Nixon had been named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Watergate cover-up. He was being investigated in connection with another dozen abuses of power, and the legal brief against him had grown enormous. And there was no question after the Watergate tapes came out that he was going to be indicted. The special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, did not want to indict him. He was looking for every opportunity to transfer the responsibility to somebody else. On top of all that, Nixon was quite ill. We'll never know exactly how ill, but he had suffered from phlebitis, which had caused him great pain, and it caused enormous swelling in his leg and had threatened to cause a stroke or a heart attack if he had a clot that got loose and into his bloodstream. Besides all that, he was obviously depressed. There were reports that he was drinking and suicidal. So Ford felt really enormous pressure right from the get-go from all sides to pardon Nixon, simply to put the Watergate morass behind the country in a way that only he could, by one swift and decisive act of presidential compassion and leniency.
Now, you think that there were personal issues in Ford's life that also led to him pardoning Nixon. What was the personal issue?
We tend to forget this now, but Gerald Ford was not born Gerald Ford. He was born Leslie King Jr. His father and mother divorced shortly after he was born. In fact, his father had started physically abusing his mother on their honeymoon. He was an alcoholic. In their divorce agreement, he was obligated to pay child support for Ford for during his growing up in Michigan, and he was a deadbeat. He never paid any of it to the point where when Ford was 25 years old and a law student at Yale, Gerald Ford's father, Leslie King, was put in jail briefly. Ford, in that, finally took the situation and became a broker between his parents. He brokered an agreement that his father would pay his mother a lump sum and the legal proceedings would go away. And this was a way of him closing out a chapter of real strain and difficulty that had dogged him throughout his life. And I believe Ford, on top of all these other pressures that he was feeling, had a kind of inner urgency to just resolve this as only he could by splitting the difference between the parties and sealing the record and getting Watergate behind the country and behind the White House so that he could go ahead and do what he needed to do, which is to lead the country out of Watergate and Vietnam.
So what was the reaction to Ford's pardoning of Nixon?
It was overwhelmingly negative. As I said earlier, Ford's popularity went from 70% to 48% and never really recovered. And it aborted what he was trying to do. After that, he was distrusted. The pardon ended up looking like the last cynical act of the Watergate cover-up. Here was President Nixon's handpicked successor telling the country that Nixon would not have to go to jail or even face trial, while 40 of his subordinates had faced legal proceedings.
Three of the people who were in the Ford administration, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz, eventually became to be considered hardliners. Were they considered hardliners in the Ford days?
Rumsfeld, was the least ideological of the three of them. But yes, I think they definitely were considered hardliners. There were many people in the military and on the right who felt that that Nixon and Kissinger had compromised America's strength, and that America needed to be strong and to be able to assert its strength around the world. And I think that was the definition of hardliner. Certainly Cheney and Wolfowitz were among that group.
What was Wolfowitz's position in the Ford administration? He went on to become a Deputy Secretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration and was considered to be one of the architects of the Iraq War.
Wolfowitz was nowhere to be found in the first 31 days. He showed up in the Ford administration as one of the key members of what was referred to as Team B. One of the things that Rumsfeld did the first time that he was at the Defense Department was he convinced Ford to set up a group that would independently review all of the intelligence that was coming into the CIA regarding the Soviet Union and its nuclear programs. They felt that the CIA was underestimating the Soviet threat. So Rumsfeld established this Team B. Wolfowitz was a key figure in that. This must have been 1974, 1975. And Team B issued a report which said that the Soviets were bent on world domination, that they were building space-based weapons to destroy us. Practically everything in that report turned out not to be true. But the Team B report became a rallying cry for hardliners who felt that that the United States had become weak and needed to become mightier and assert that might around the world. So this was really, in a way, a kind of a bookend to the so-called independence intelligence gathering that was done in the Defense Department in the run-up to the Iraq War, in which Wolfowitz was involved.
And did Cheney and Rumsfeld support Team B in their conclusions that later?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think this, you know, by the end, you know, Nixon had negotiated the first strategic arms reductions and was in the process of negotiating what was called SALT II, which was the second stage of that. By the end of the Ford presidency, Rumsfeld and Cheney had pretty much run SALT II into the ground. The word détente was no longer used in any of Ford's speeches, and the United States was starting to assert a more militant posture towards the world. This was part of their answer to Vietnam, which is, you know, we didn't lose Vietnam. We're stronger than ever.
Do you feel like you understand Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz any better from having studied their role in the Ford administration?
The Ford administration was truly the formative experience for them. I think they developed their attitudes towards the world and their position on America's role in the world as the sole superpower during that period. Of course, then we were still engaged in the Cold War with the Soviets, but this is where they prepared and trained for the power that they have had in the Bush administration. So in that sense, it's like going back to somebody's childhood to sort of figure out why they became the way that they did. I think we can understand a lot about Rumsfeld and Cheney by looking at how they became powerful the first time. And it should be remembered that at the time, Rumsfeld was 44 and Cheney was 33. When he became White House Chief of Staff, he was 35, the youngest Chief of Staff in history. So this was really his training.
Barry Wirth, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Barry Wirth is the author of the new book, 31 Days. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Understanding the Crucial Link Between Mothers, Daughters, and Health by Dr. Christiane Northrup. From Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start May 1st at capella.edu. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, journalist Neil McFarquhar. He's written a new satirical novel based on his experiences covering the Gulf War. He's reported from war zones without a scratch, but was nearly killed riding a bike in Manhattan. Also, Jeff Nunberg considers the meanings of the word alien, and John Powers tells us about two hit films from South Korea, now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alien, illegal, undocumented, immigrant. The debate over immigration policy is also about the words used by the various sides. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg says the language of immigration has been controversial for as long as immigration has been an issue in American life.
Back in 1920, the New Republic reported on an exercise in which the students at a New England college were asked to provide definitions of the word alien. Their answers were uniformly negative. A person who is hostile to this country, a person on the opposite side, an enemy from a foreign land. Commenting on those responses, Walter Lippmann remarked on how odd it was that emotional meaning should attach to what was in fact an exact legal term. But by then, the word alien had been colored by decades of anti-immigrant sentiment, which reached its peak in the Red Scares of the years after World War I. Fully 90% of communist and anarchist agitation is traceable to aliens, the Attorney General and presidential hopeful A. Mitchell Palmer announced in 1920, by way of justifying the raids that rounded up and deported 10,000 suspected radicals whom he described as aliens of misshapen cast of mind. Or as the American Legion Weekly put it, aliens are not of our sort. That's a chronic feature of the language of immigration. The words refuse to be confined to their legal and economic senses, but swell with emotional meanings that reflect the fears and passions of the time. True, alien no longer conjures up images of wild-eyed, bomb-throwing anarchists. Not even the fiercest opponents of immigration reform claim that the Mexicans, Chinese, and Irish who enter the country illegally are seeking anything but economic opportunity. But alien still suggests strangeness and difference, people who are not of our sort. That's partly due to the science fiction writers who picked the word up in the 1930s to refer to extraterrestrial beings. And it's revealing that alien is far more likely to be used to describe Mexicans and Central Americans than Europeans. The tens of thousands of Irish and Poles who are in the country illegally are almost always referred to as immigrants, not aliens. An anti-immigrationist almost never uses aliens to describe foreigners who are in the country legally. On news broadcasts, illegal aliens outnumbers legal aliens by about 100-1. Nowadays, those connotations have led the majority of the mainstream media to steer clear of the word aliens. Illegal immigrants tends to be the phrase of choice. But illegal has something more than a technical meaning, too. True, dictionaries define the word simply as not according to law. But there are disparaging connotations to the negative prefix in illegal, which is actually just a variant of the prefix in. Inhuman doesn't mean the same thing as not human, and you don't become irreligious simply by not going to church. And you hear the same negative tone in words like insincere, inflexible, and illegitimate. So it isn't surprising that we reserve illegal for conveying strong disapproval. We may talk about illegal drugs, but we don't describe the Porsche 959 as an illegal car, even though it can't be legally driven in the U.S. Then, too, we don't usually describe lawbreakers as being illegal in themselves. Jack Abramoff may have done illegal lobbying, but nobody's called him an illegal lobbyist. And whatever laws Bernie Ebbers or Martha Stewart may have broken, they weren't illegal CEOs. It's only your immigration status that can qualify you as being an illegal person, or that can earn you the honor of being an illegal all by itself. That use of illegal as a noun actually goes back a long ways. The British coined it in the 1930s to describe Jews who entered Palestine without official permission, and it's been used ever since as a way of reducing individuals to their infractions. But where to find neutral language? Out of desperation, people sometimes turn to borrowing words from other languages, but that can have its pitfalls too. Guest worker sounds a lot more precious than the German word Gastarbeiter it was based on. In German, after all, Gast can mean simply visitor. And then there's undocumented. That word was introduced in the 1970s as a version of the French phrase sans papier, or without papers, which is used in a number of other nations to describe immigrants who have no legal status. At the recent rallies across the country, Spanish speakers were using the equivalent sin papeles. There's no question undocumented is the most decent word that's available to us. But something was lost in that translation, too. It isn't just that undocumented adds a bureaucratic note, but that it focuses on the government's records rather than the immigrants themselves. Visitors who overstay their visas may not be undocumented in the strict sense of the term, which is why the INS ultimately decided to stay with illegal. But those people are still without papers in the more suggestive European sense, people who have to live without any official status in the shadow of a modern state. Aliens, illegals, even undocumented, over the past 100 years, it's been in the nature of the language of immigration to suppress the human side of the story. Yet language can't wholly obscure those realities. As the Swiss writer Max Frisch wrote in 1965 about the European experience with immigration, We called for a labor force, but it was human beings that came.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, journalist Neil McFarquhar. He covered the Arab world for more than 12 years. He's written a new satirical novel about the press corps during the Gulf War. This is Fresh Air. After spending 5 years as the New York Times Cairo bureau chief, Neil McFarquhar is starting a new beat covering Muslims in America. He worked as a reporter in the Arab world for more than 12 years. His new satirical novel, The Sand Cafe, is based on his experiences in 1991, covering the Gulf War from Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, for the Associated Press. What's one of the more absurd or ridiculous parts of reporting on the Gulf War that you weren't able to actually put in print at the time that you were reporting, but you were able to describe as fiction in your novel?
Personally, as a reporter, I'm a little bit adverse to reporting about the press, but I think there is some interest on the part of readers or TV viewers about how reporters get the story. And the events that are portrayed in the Sand Cafe kind of highlight the absurdity of the situation in Dhahran during the lead-up to the Gulf War, because basically there were 1,000 reporters there, and there were 190 rooms in the hotel, and there were 100 slots initially on the combat pool. So it was basically 1,000 reporters vying for 100 slots, although they expanded that later. And I think what I try and bring out in the Sand Cafe is just sort of the ridiculous array of reporters that ended up there. You know, one of the women's fashion magazines had sent a lesbian poet who ran around in black leather and, you know, was asking troops whether they'd brought sex toys along with them. And there was somebody from Audubon magazine, because Saddam had opened the oil spigots and all the cormorants were soaked in oil, what we used to call the dirty bird stories. And there was somebody from Soldier of Fortune magazine. And it just seemed like every publication on earth had a reporter in that hotel. And obviously, the complaints about access were written about at the time, but you really, in the stories, couldn't get the full absurdity of having so many different kinds of reporters under one roof, all battling for very limited access.
How did your experiences covering the Gulf War affect how you see coverage now of Iraq?
I think the military has been trying to evolve its own coverage. So, as I said, there were initially 100 combat slots during the Gulf War, and that was eventually expanded to about 160, I think. And the number of embedded reporters at the beginning of this war was 500 to 600. But the problems that you see in the Sand Cafe in reporting events in the first Gulf War also carried over into the Iraq War, because the Scud attacks and all the things that could be reported from the hotel become much more important. And that also happened in real life, of course, in Dhahran, because everyone had access to the Scud attacks. And even though they wouldn't change the course of the war one iota, that was what became the nightly news or the main headline. And I think with the embedding during the Iraq War, yes, you got intensive personal stories about what the soldiers were doing, but they tend to be exaggerated slightly. I mean, if we take the Jessica Lynch story, it was a moving human drama and obviously news. But events like that sort of get blown up out of proportion because news organizations devote so many resources to getting their reporters embedded. And so the focus becomes what's happening around their reporter. And I think you lose some of the larger picture. And certainly in Iraq, while it was a very difficult reporting experience, you didn't get the sense of any kind of stirring among the Iraqis or any resistance among the Iraqis to the American presence. And I think that, you know, the march to Baghdad became this sort of glorious victory, which really had nothing to do in the end with, you know, the terrible, bloody consequences of toppling that government.
Neil, in March of 2005, you wrote that elections and events in the Middle East, in Lebanon and Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Palestinian territories, Iraq, have all combined to give the sense, however tentative, that twilight might be descending on authoritarian Arab government. A combination of outside pressure and internal shifts has merged to create this moment. Arabs of a younger, more savvy generation appear more willing to take their dissatisfaction directly to the front stoop of repressive leaders. Still feel that way?
A little less, I guess. You know, there was a combination of events there that seemed like it was coming together to really push for change. But I think a number of events have changed that. First of all, the continuation of bloodshed in Iraq. And I think one of the things that's striking about coming back to the United States after so many years in the Middle East is you can't turn around over there without having some sense that, you know, there's a war in the region and a big war. You turn on the TV and it's the first headline and, you know, people are talking about it in coffee shops. And, you know, because I'm an American and you can't see me, but I'm 6'4" and I have blonde hair, so I look like an American. So I'm accosted on the street about the war when I talk to people. And it's just part of the everyday vocabulary in a way that it is not here. And I think that's really kind of soured people on democracy because the United States, to a certain extent, sold the war in the region as, you know, this is going to be the end of despots and force everyone to change. And there was certainly some initial push toward that. I mean, the fact that the United States sent its army in there to topple a dictator gave all the other leaders in the region pause. But a number of things have changed that. I mean, because the leaders can point to Iraq and say, you want democracy, that's what it is. And since there's no experience with democracy in the region, people fear that any change really will descend into the kind of bloodshed that they see every day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Neil McFarquhar. You were the Times Cairo bureau chief for 5 years. In the last election in Egypt in 2005, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamist group, did very well. And it was the freest election in 50 years. How much power does this group actually have now?
Well, there is a parliament in Egypt. It's kind of a rubber stamp parliament. And most of the power in Egypt lies with President Mubarak. But in capturing between a fifth and a quarter of the seat, there are 444 seats in parliament, and the Muslim Brothers got almost 100. That gives them a huge voice to press for change and, you know, to try and embarrass the National Democratic Party. And it gives them kind of a stick to poke the government with, which is one reason I think that the government of Hosni Mubarak has delayed municipal elections, because they're worried about that growing power and growing visibility of the Muslim Brothers.
What does the Muslim Brotherhood want? Its slogan is Islam is the solution. What's the agenda?
And that slogan is what gives people pause, because it can be anything, you know, because the solution for what? And I think when you talk to people on the street, you know, they just want a sense that someone's listening. And the Muslim Brotherhood does that very well. I followed one candidate in a very poor quarter in Alexandria, and people voted for him because he'd gotten the streets paved, he'd gotten the garbage collected, and he was seen as uncorrupt. Whereas the government candidate was kind of a rich businessman who was perfectly nice, but, you know, he'd never been in the neighborhood before. And I think the most telling interview I had was an engineer came up to me after the rally, and he said, you know, yes, I'm religious, and yes, I believe in the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, but I'm not voting for them because I want another form of despotism. I'm not voting for them because I want the religious system to replace the system of Hosni Mubarak. I'm voting for them because I want change and I want a good system so that if they turn out to be bums, I can throw them out. And I think that's the appeal of the Muslim Brotherhood, is that they are seen as the best chance for real change. But, of course, it's a gamble because people are worried that, you know, in the end that they will seize power and not let real democracy unfold.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Neil McFarquhar, and he's just written a new satirical novel based on his experiences covering the Gulf War in 1991, and it's called The Sand Cafe. You've survived a lot of things in your time as a reporter, but you were nearly killed on a bicycle in Manhattan in 1997. What happened?
Well, I fortunately or unfortunately don't remember it. My memory consists of being on my bicycle on Fifth Avenue 1 minute and the next being on a stretcher being run through a corridor, just seeing the fluorescent lights overhead flash by, but not really knowing where I was. What basically happened was I was riding my bike down Fifth Avenue and a bus driver had an epileptic seizure and fell over the wheel, and the bus kept going and it knocked me off my bicycle.
Wow. What was the damage that was done to you?
I was in a coma for about 10 days, and I was in the hospital for about 4 months. I lost a kidney, and I lost my left hip, and about 20% of the nerves in my leg. And I was in a wheelchair for 8 months, and then took about 2 years to get off a cane. But, you know, one of my doctors said to me, you know, you got really banged up, but you had a bit of luck. And part of that luck is he hit me on 28th Street and 5th Avenue and 1st Avenue. And 28th Street is the entrance to Bellevue Emergency Room. So I got it to one of the best trauma teams in the country within half an hour or so. And they basically saved my life.
Are you still dealing with a lot of pain?
It's, you know, I mean, there's certain things I can't do, long car trips, long airplane rides, things like that. But, you know, I went to Iraq and I felt comfortable reporting there. I mean, there are limits to the amount of danger I can face just because, as the doctor said, you're missing too many body parts already to lose any more. But, you know, it's all manageable.
How has this changed your sense of what a sensible risk is? Because again, you know, you've covered war. You've been in really dangerous parts of the world, and you came out unscratched. And then on Fifth Avenue, you got really terribly hurt in an accident, a driver with an epileptic seizure. So what has that done to your sense of measuring risk in a reasonable way?
You take less, obviously, because, you know that the it's funny because when you've been through great pain, you think, well, you know, it inures you to it, but it doesn't. It makes you much more hesitant. So knowing what you've been through, it's like, okay, I'm not going to go through anything that puts me into that level of trauma again. At the same time, you also, though, you empathize with people who are going through trauma much, much more. You know, because when you see the victims of accidents and you see the victims of bombings and things like that, I don't know, it just puts your emotions much more closer to the surface. But I think you get much more level-headed just about assessing what stories you can and cannot do. And there's some, you know, I mean, I think Iraq is an incredibly interesting story, but I just have to accept the fact that I personally can't do it.
So you became the Cairo bureau chief after recovering from your injuries?
Yes.
And you felt well enough to go abroad and do that?
I was fine. I felt like I had enough mobility. I talked to my surgeons about it, and they said, you know, just don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to get a blood infection, because that will cause you terrible problems with all the metal in you. And I, you know, the wonder of email, I would send an email to my doctor. I'm saying, you know, I'm in Baghdad and there's car bombs going off. What do you think? And I'd get back usually cryptic one-liner like, perhaps a more stable environment would be better.
Your new beat for the New York Times, which you're starting right now, is covering Muslims in North America. This is a weird question, but you speak Arabic. Are you ever like in a taxi or at a food stand or someplace in New York or California where somebody's having, say, like a cell phone call or a conversation that they assume you don't understand, but you do understand? As a reporter covering Muslims in America, do you learn things overhearing conversations that people don't think you understand?
I haven't done it. I just came back from the Middle East about 6 weeks ago, so I haven't really started reporting yet. So that hasn't happened yet. But it happened in Baghdad a lot, in like the Ministry of Information offices and things like that.
What did you get overhearing in the Ministry of Information office?
You know, we were always watched in Baghdad, and there were so many reporters right before the war. In the week before the war, they brought in a bunch of new minders, and the head of the press office yelled at one of the new minders, and he was waving a piece of paper at him, and he said, "You call this a report? You didn't even say who these reporters interviewed. We need much more about what they did every day."
Great. That must have inspired a lot of confidence.
Yeah, to sort of confirm what we had always feared or knew.
Well, Neil McFarquhar, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Neil McFarquhar is a reporter for the New York Times and author of the new satirical novel, The Sand Cafe, based on his experiences covering the Gulf War. Coming up, critic at large John Powers tells us about the best crime movie he's seen in years. It's now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. DVDs have enabled us to see movies from some unlikely places. Our critic at large, John Power, says that some of the best films he's seen come from South Korea.
I often hear people complain that foreign movies just aren't what they used to be. Where's the new Truffaut, they ask? The new Fellini? The short answer is, in Asia. And at the moment, the most exciting place in Asia is South Korea, whose culture is just exploding. Its pop singers and TV stars are hot from Seoul to Singapore. And its film industry keeps cranking out vibrant movies, ranging from Tarantino-esque thrillers like the international hit Old Boy to the refined art films of Hong Sang-soo, who dissects Korean machismo in a literary style reminiscent of Eric Rohmer. Although it's still hard to see Korean movies in our theaters, many of the good ones are now available on DVD. And in fact, two of the very best ones have just come out. The first is a Korean hit called Memories of Murder by the gifted filmmaker Bong Joon-ho. Based on a true story, this is the best crime movie I've seen in several years. It's smart, funny, and unsettling. The action takes place in a 1980s small town and begins with the discovery of a woman's corpse. The film's hero, Detective Park, is a cocky, jocular, weirdly likable cop who sets about solving her murder the old-fashioned way. This largely involves beating confessions out of anyone he finds suspicious. But when that doesn't work, he's joined by a smug big city cop who insists he'll solve the crime scientifically. The movie's amusing first hour follows these cops as they scour the community, joking and bickering and brawling. But as more women start to get killed, the story deepens and takes on moral weight. The detectives get worn down by the horror of what they're investigating. This is especially true of Detective Park, brilliantly played by Song Kang-ho, who emerges as a frivolous man sobered by the experience of dealing with terrible things that may just be inexplicable. And as in a Hollywood crime film like, say, Chinatown, we gradually grasp that we're actually being shown a portrait of a whole society. We see Korean culture during the 80s dictatorship, with its quiet complicities and repression. There aren't enough police officers pursuing the killer because so many are being used to clamp down on protests against the military dictatorship. Korea's dictatorial past is also the theme of The President's Last Bang, which is based on an even stranger true story. On October 26, 1979, South Korea's president-slash-dictator Park Chung-hee was gunned down by the head of the Korean CIA during one of the president's notorious boozing and womanizing sessions at his mansion. The killer claimed he was striking a blow against the dictatorship. Now, this was shocking stuff. I mean, just imagine Richard Nixon being shot down by J. Edgar Hoover at an orgy. And what filmmaker Im Sang-soo has done with this event inspired controversy with its irreverent subversiveness. Rather than treat the assassination with the customary docudrama blandness, he's turned the whole episode into jet-black comedy. It's like remaking Oliver Stone's JFK in the style of Dr. Strangelove. In capturing the events of one murderous night, filmmaker Im conjures up a corrupt ruling order, populated by self-loathing bureaucrats, good-time gals, cynical secret servicemen, small-time fall guys, and politicians who philander as if every woman is their last. In the process, the president's last bang shows how big events actually happen in all their sad, funny, messy energy. This isn't the clockwork Hollywood hokum of Syriana, where George Clooney arrives in the desert precisely in time to get zapped by a missile. Instead, the movie treats Park's assassination as a stew of self-promotion, cross-purposes, lousy communications, highfalutin ideals, and people dashing off to the toilet for bouts of nervous diarrhea. By treating the assassination as a grandiose farce, Im captures a profound truth often left out of the textbooks. History isn't neat. But it is important to everyone. And part of what makes memories of murder and the president's last bang so memorable is that they're so accessible and entertaining. And these movies are not alone. One reason Korean film culture is so alive is that so many of its best filmmakers grapple with big issues in commercial movies aimed at the mass audience, just as Hollywood famously did back in the 70s heyday of Easy Riders and Raging Bulls. In fact, watching these two Korean movies be smart, politically savvy, and fun to watch, you may find yourself complaining yet again that American movies just aren't what they used to be.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From the Roth Family Foundation for the NPR Endowment, helping to fund NPR's West Coast Production Center. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. He died Wednesday at the age of 81. He was an activist for civil rights and against the war in Vietnam. He was chaplain of Yale University in the 60s and head of Manhattan's influential Riverside Church in the 70s. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.